Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 22nd, 2005. This session is When Redemption Fails, presented by Dan McAdams in the Creekside Room, disc number MCD 2005-05. Let's listen in.
I've developed, and my students and colleagues have developed, ways to measure individual differences in generativity. At any given time, who's high in generativity? Who are the people who are at the high end of the bell-shaped curve on generativity, okay? People move around on the curve quite a bit, but maybe, some people come to the fore and they're extremely committed to promoting the next generation. And other people, well, there's other things going on in life, and maybe they're distracted from that. Or Erickson talked about self-preoccupation. Instead of caring for the next generation, maybe you spend most of your time caring for yourself. Maybe you need to do that. So there are, there's lots of variations in generativity. Highly generative adults. I mean, the room is filled with them here, I suspect, okay? This is not a random sampling of people across the world. People in this room are likely to be quite committed to promoting the well-being of the next generation. Highly generative adults are caring, productive, and socially responsible men and women who are often active in their communities, and religious institutions, and civic affairs. Talk a lot about that one day, the different research that has shown things like, for example, people who score high in generativity, they also tend to vote. Okay, they're actively involved in the political process. They tend to be very involved in their kids' education. They know the names of their kids' teachers. They get involved in the PTA. They're really doers and joiners and sometimes meddlers too. Okay, they're out there trying to make things happen in the community. Compared to less generative people. Now, what I'm mainly interested in here is the way in which highly generative midlife adults make sense of their lives. Okay, and this gets to the third point on that handout there, that page, the idea of narrative identity. Narrative identity refers to the story that you're working on. My view here, and this is not an unusual view, and certain areas of psychology, is that beginning in our early adulthood years, late adolescence, early adulthood, we start putting together a story for who we are. And this story serves to make sense of our lives, to provide our lives with some kind of unity and purpose. And perhaps you have many stories about your life. People collect narratives. But the important thing to know here on stories is that, it's not like a video replay. It's not like Antonio playing back this tape down the road. Your life is not like that. We can push a button and just replay the last 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, or whatever, objectively and veridically. People remember selectively, and they reconstruct. Okay, so let's say I'm a 30-year-old young doctor, okay, physician, all right? And how do I reconstruct my past? Well, being a doctor is very important to me. I want to help people, save people. Maybe I want to work overseas, Doctors Without Borders, and so forth. And so this is part of who I am today. How do I remember my past? Well, that science teacher I had in sixth grade, boy, was he important, okay? He got me interested in science, and science is really important for medicine. And, my pastor in my church says, Danny, you really need to help people. You've got gifts in that area. And so I remember that. And, there was this guy on my street who was a doctor, and I dated a nurse when I was in college, too. Well, all these aren't random memories, okay? They kind of fit with who you currently are. And there's a lot of that happens in narrative identity. We remember the past in a certain way so as to make it, to make sense of who we are today. And a lot of stuff we just forget or, consider to be unimportant. So what I do in my research, my students, we collect life stories from people. And we have a protocol for doing this, an interview, and we have questionnaires and so forth. And people basically tell us about high points in their lives, low points, turning points. We did a little bit of this here Tuesday, where I asked people to think about a turning point moment in their lives, a scene that stands out as marking a change in your life. And people talked about what those were and how you might think about them and so on. So people have these stories. We're all walking around with them. And I try to get them, collect them, and analyze them. highly generative adults, that is, adults who score high on measures of generativity, these caring and productive adults, their stories tend to look a little bit alike, okay? Not all stories, I mean, every story is unique, but you start to see patterns after you look at stories for a long time. And in our research, we have looked for many years at the life stories told by highly generative adults in their midlife years. So we got them right here. We've got 100 stories here. And then we compare those stories to a group, stories told by adults less generative, matched on age and income. And these less generative adults, by the way, they're not, you know, sociopaths or bad people. They're just not as generative. Okay, I kind of seek out the generativity superstars out there, the people who are really distinguished themselves for their generativity. I look at their stories, and I compare their stories, you know, like if you've taken introductory psychology, they have a control group. My low generative people are like a control group. I'm comparing back and forth. What differentiates the two groups? The biggest theme that differentiates the stories between the two groups is the theme of redemption. It's the main theme of this series. And by redemption here, I mean something very watered down that would not pass any kind of litmus or any kind of test that perhaps a rigorous theologian or philosopher might have in mind. I've got something really basic and simple and psychological. And by redemption, what I mean is moving from suffering or something negative, pain, sadness, anger, moving from that, an experience in which you move from that to something positive. You are delivered from suffering to an enhanced status or state. And it turns out that the life stories of highly generative adults are, you know, filled with that kind of imagery. Okay? They love to tell you those kinds of stories. Statistically, it's about a 3-to-1 difference, highly generative adults versus less generative adults. Highly generative adults tell stories that have more of this redemption stuff in them. Less generative adults, they've got some of it too, but not as much. Their stories illustrate other kinds of themes, interesting themes often. You know, it's not like our highly generative adults are better storytellers or more interesting people. It's not like that. You get interesting stories all over the place. But the theme of redemption comes out loud and clear in our research, in the life stories of highly generative, caring and productive American midlife adults. Okay? And I emphasize the American part because there are certain other themes that come up in these stories that I think have a certain kind of cultural cachet. That it's as if highly generative adults in our society are major spokespersons for some of the most cherished values and stories in our heritage as Americans. And so they will use themes and metaphors in their stories that play with some of these cherished ideas. For example, you can ask, well, how does the story begin? How does your life story begin? Highly generative adults are about 4 times more likely than the rest of us to tell life stories that begin in childhood, okay, with, well, you know, I was blessed in some way. I was fortunate. I was one of the chosen people. Now, they don't use that word. Nobody talks that way about their life. But they'll say things like, you know, I had this wonderful experience when I was 4 that set me apart from others. Or I had this talent that nobody else had. Or, you know, Dad took me under his wing. He seemed to care for me more than my sibs, and that's always been something that I cherish. Well, everybody can come up with something like that, probably, but highly generative adults make a big deal out of it, as I pointed out in previous sessions. They tend to start their story that way, and at the same time, they'll say things like, early on in life, okay, when I was a kid, I remember a lot of bad things happening to other people. Suffering that other people had, injustice, oppression. Now, highly generative adults, to begin with, I think, are more sensitive to injustice and oppression. I think, in general, they are. As they think back on their own lives, they set it up to suggest that they've been that way for a long time. So how does my story start as a highly generative adult? I'm special. I'm fortunate in some way. I'm blessed. Others suffer. Okay? Or, to put it differently, I am a good, innocent, gifted protagonist, main character, in a dangerous world. I move out into a dangerous world. And this is the feeling, the you get in the life stories of highly generative adults. There are other themes that run through it. One that I like because I don't like, which is to say it's a surprise to me, and I can't relate to it in my own life. But there is a kind of moral clarity and steadfastness that often runs through the life stories of highly generative adults. When they're talking about their teenage years and their young adulthood, they'll often say things to suggest to you that through a religious tradition or through my family or through some social influence, I got my values cleared away, I committed myself to some basic truths about life, whatever they are, the golden rule, of, you know, what I learned in Sunday school, the lessons my mother taught me. They don't have to be simplistic, they can be sort of profound, but they're clear, they're straightforward. And I'm committed to that stuff, darn it. That's what I believe in, and you know, I haven't changed much. Last 40, 50 years I've been going along, you know, it's not like I wake up in the middle of the night and think, my goodness, what do I believe? You know, what's true? What's good? What does life mean? That's not the way highly generative adults talk about themselves. Less generative adults often talk about themselves. Highly generative adults have this sort of like confidence in their story. It puts me off a little bit sometimes, I have to tell you, even though I like to think I'm a generative person. But this aspect of the story, it does suggest that the protagonist is solidly ensconced in a value system. As you move forward in life, bad things happen, but good things prevail for highly generative adults. Redemption paves the way. These stories have progress. They move forward. You get the sense that in the story, the protagonist is upward and onward. Okay, there are setbacks. Bad things happen. You get stuck for a while. Maybe you get pushed back. First marriage didn't work out, right? You were depressed for a couple of years after that, but then you rebounded, you came back after that. So there are setbacks, but there are continual upward progression is part of the story. Less generative adults don't have stories that go in that direction. And as people look to the future then, highly generative adults see it in positive terms. They see growth. They see that they're going to leave a positive legacy for the next generation. Makes sense, they're generative people. So that's really what the redemptive self is. It's that kind of story, okay? A story where it begins that you're the blessed hero from childhood in a dangerous world. You get your values squared away. You know what you believe as a young person. You move forward in life. You encounter lots of obstacles, adversity of all kinds. You triumph over it, usually, not always, but usually. And you don't always do it on your own. People help you out. And that adversity can come in many forms. It can come through sin, okay, self-indulgence. It can come through enslavement, feeling that you're in bondage to somebody else. Like that first relationship I had, you know, I mean, I just couldn't get away from her. I was trapped. I was imprisoned. But finally, I was emancipated. I freed myself. That's a redemptive image. It can be poverty. And it can be, with lots of other examples. In American culture, we talked a little bit about this Wednesday, you know, there's some favorite ways to narrate redemption. The rags to riches story is a great one. It goes back to Benjamin Franklin, Horatio Alger, and so forth. The immigrant story, you come here with nothing. You build up things, you steadily improve, you become part of the American dream, you get the house, you finally get the property. The next generation builds on that. The next generation builds on that. Upward, onward progress. Highly generative adults in our society, they use those kinds of tropes and metaphors to talk about their lives. Okay. Yesterday we talked a little bit about how this imagery that I've been talking about here, the redemptive self, is used not only psychologically, but it's in culture, in political rhetoric, and how different politicians, for example, will sell their own life stories as the redemptive self. It's not like they, you know, read something on this. It's just sort of part of the cultural milieu. People like stories like this. They like it when the protagonist suffers and then comes out. They want a leader who has firm values, right? Moral clarity and so forth. They get a little nervous if they can't trust where that protagonist is going to go down the road. And I, you know, we speculated a little bit about the extent to which, you know, certain politicians, in particular our current president, perhaps have used this kind of imagery unwittingly and perhaps intentionally to good effect. Okay, I mean, these are stories that people like. These are stories that are compelling. I think that, you know, there are many reasons that the Republicans won the last election in 2004, and I think one of them is that they really are better storytellers. I mean, and I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way, although I'll confess that I did not vote for our president last time, more than the time before. But there is a certain way in which, you know, I think policy and politicians, for good or ill, tap into narratives that we find compelling. Well, I think the redemptive self is compelling to lots of different people, liberal and conservative, but I actually think the conservatives have been a little bit more effective in recent years in using redemption images involving things like, you know, the upwardly mobile individual, the American dream, and other ideas that go with the redemptive self to their advantage. Okay, so that's kind of what we've been doing. What I've been talking about this week, and I thought I'd take a minute or two here since I'm getaway to entertain some issues and questions that come up. They can be based on what I just said. They can be based on previous sessions. They can be baseless. They can just be whatever is on your mind right now regarding these sorts of issues. And we'll do that a little bit, and then we'll move. I'll ask you a couple other questions regarding what might be wrong with this story. What might not be so great about it? I think it's a great story. And we talked about this the other day. It's a psychologically powerful story. I mean, generativity, you know, ain't for the faint of heart, okay? It's tough work to get out there and promote the next generation. I mean, anybody who's been a parent knows it ain't easy, right? I mean, your kids, how are they going to turn out? Nobody knows. And are they grateful? Like never, in my case. Right? I mean, as King Lear, I quoted this the other day. I mean, in Lear, he at one point he screams out or says something like, I'm going to lose it right now. I don't remember the exact quote, but it's something like, nothing is more painful. Oh shoot, I can't think of it. Sharper than a serpent's tooth is the ingratitude. Sharper than a serpent's tooth is to have a thankless child. Yes. Helped to drive Lear to madness. Somebody pointed out after the session that, well, it was kind of a simplification. I mean, a lot of things. He was probably mad already, and he wasn't especially generative. All right. But still, generativity is tough work. Whether it's through parenting, through political work, through volunteer work, through, investing, you know, your heart and soul into an endeavor, like, say, the family business, okay? I mean, to take that example. I mean, this is your baby, and I use that term appropriately. It's, you gave birth to this, and it's grown, and now you're going to pass it down to the next generation, and your kids are going to take it. And maybe they'll screw it up, or maybe it'll just get screwed up, or maybe it just won't be appreciated, or you'll have some insight, or, you know, like in my profession, can we write? I do a lot of writing. I mean, basically, that's what I get paid to do, teach and write. And so, you know, I write an article, and I'm thinking, you know, students will love it, and sometimes, but, you know, a lot of times, yeah. Or they misinterpret it, you know, you're never understood. There's so many ways that generativity can go awry. And therefore, if you have a life story, if you've worked on a sense of yourself that suggests that, yeah, there's going to be a lot of suffering, okay? But hey, good things usually follow bad stuff. Redemption is typical, although not always predictable. And after all, you're lucky. You're special, okay? You early on had a break that other people didn't have. Oh, yeah, Mom liked me the best. I remember. Or, in my case, I was a premature baby. My dad told me this. It's true, I was premature, 3 pounds, 13 ounces, in California in the early 1950s. But other things, like my dad told me, well, you know, Danny, you had a 50-50 chance to live. I believed him as a kid. My mom later has told me that that was completely ridiculous. My life was never in jeopardy. But, you know, this is early on in life. Okay, remember, okay. Oh, I was lucky. You know, 50-50. They flipped a coin, it came up heads. So, well, what do you do with that? All right? I mean, well, I could make a narrative out of it. I think maybe I have, unconsciously to a certain extent. Like, well, I was blessed. I mean, like, maybe I should do something with my life. Important. All right? I got lucky. I should give back in gratitude.
we were talking about this, I think, yesterday, the relationship between gratitude and generativity. And generativity is often motivated by a kind of gratitude. Highly generative adults will talk about gratitude. They'll say, okay, good things have happened to me. Now it's my turn to give back to my world. So, questions? Yes, sir.
I keep coming back to thinking, bringing this to the church. And one of our tasks is to help people kind of rewrite their own story in a redemptive way so that they can have generative lives.
Got it.
But I think the biggest task has always been trying to help people see themselves in light of the story of God instead of rewriting their own life.
So that distinction, maybe you could flesh it out a little more. So, you distinguish between seeing one's life in the context of the story of God on the one hand versus writing your own story on the other.
Rewrite your own life story in light of the grace of God.
Right.
And you might be more likely to see those low times as times that have essentially helped hone you, put you on a new track. It's very popular in American or civil religion. Someone goes through a catastrophic event, and they say after 120 other people have died, that God has chosen me, that it's my special time, and that I'm going to be doing, he's saving me for something else. That seems very popular in American culture. We don't have the same kind of chutzpah, I think, when it comes to that in the church.
That's interesting.
But at the same time, I think there's something to be said for finding ways that maybe God has called you to a special task.
I think your points raise a number of very interesting issues. Just a couple of comments on that to come to my mind as you're talking. I mean, it's no accident that highly generative, that there is a positive correlation between generativity and some involvement in a religious tradition. And typically, we're dealing in my samples with Judeo-Christian traditions of one kind or another. And so I think there are generativity resources in religious tradition. But in addition, you raised the issue, and I haven't really emphasized this enough, and I'm glad you brought it up, how we don't just sit down and make up our own story out of thin air. I mean, we do it within a cultural context. And so by finding the ways in which your story connects to the broader meta-narrative of Christ's life and so forth, and of our understanding of our religious tradition, I mean, it is very much, that really goes together. And I think people do that. They, whatever their context, they draw from it. And I think in the Christian church, we provide so many resources there. And indeed, I think part of what we are trying to do, maybe unwittingly, is to help people create lives that matter, lives that whose stories are redemptive, and to help us be generative. Other thoughts? Yeah?
Something that kind of goes along with that, possibly, is I think about people trying to, possibly highly generative people trying to not push their thoughts or their beliefs on other individuals, but saying, oftentimes, I will see with, someone diagnosed with a terminal illness, well, there's a purpose for that. There's a reason. Now you have shorter term life. You can seek out good. Or loved one dies. Well, God has called them. There's a reason for that. Which is the absolute worst thing to ever say to anybody that is in despair, that's suffering a personal tragedy. And yet, I see that happening. And is that the highly generative people? Do you see?
Well, it's certainly it's not unique to highly generative people, but you're raising some issues that actually get at the potential downsides to high generativity. I mean, generativity comes in all kinds of flavors, and some people are generative in a kind of heavy-handed way. And they mean well, and they do well, okay? But I mean, I think you'd be a great example there. You're trying to console somebody, you're trying to provide a meaningful response, and
Maybe it's not the right one in that situation. I mean, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. You never really know. But there's nothing to keep highly generative people from, like, being right in your face with what they believe. After all, they do believe stuff. They are committed to things, okay? I mean, you know, highly generative people don't take life lightly. You know, it's like, yeah, we're here, we'll pass our time. I mean, they're not laid back that way, okay? They may be able to relax, you know, like come to hold and hang out for a while, and I feel good. But they got a purpose, okay? Talk about the purpose-driven life. I mean, highly generative adults, they're on to something. And so it would not be unusual for that kind of thing to develop. And so, well, I mean, could be a potential problem. I mean, there is something about this story, the redemptive self, in which, you know, you have somebody here who's telling a narrative in which the protagonist is gifted with the truth, okay? Now, you know, you don't have to be arrogant about that. You don't have to, like, lord it over others. But, you know, that kind of quiet confidence, even, that comes in that kind of life narrative, can sometimes lead to this kind of sense that, you know, listen, I know what's good. And so, yeah, I mean, I would say generative people are more likely to do that, but I think that's a potential problem in generativity. You know, generativity, there's a real fine line here. I mean, like, you've got something to offer, but you also have to sometimes step back and let go, even with your own kids. I mean, you know, eventually you let them go. We see it as kind of launching the children out. Now, you don't just send them off into space and they never come back, but, you know, gradually children, you know, they get away, and there needs to be some sort of freeing up of the generative object so that they can go on and make their own story and their own contributions. So,
the second part to that is, do you notice that in the highly generative people that they tend to see the good come when they're in the midst of their suffering?
Well, I don't know that. That's a really good question, because everything I do is retrospective. It's the story about the past and the future, but I don't get them in periods of crisis. But there is research. It's not related to generativity so much, but there is research on that phenomenon, when people are going through difficult periods, and are they seeing anything good in it? We talked a little bit a few days ago about benefit-finding research in the medical profession, or the medical research. And here you've got, for example, people who are stricken with an illness, recent cardiac arrest. So patients who've had a cardiac event, and very, very recently, and then they're interviewed and they ask, well, you know, like, do you think there's anything positive about this heart attack you just had last week? You know, some people will say, yeah, you know, something positive did come out of that for me. You know, I think that that it helped me get closer to my family, or maybe it helped me slow down and smell the coffee and feel good about life. And other people will say, yeah, tell you the truth, I don't see much good in it. Well, the people who see benefit in adversity when they're in it, down the road, that research suggests, are doing better. So one predictor of not having a second heart attack is interpreting your first one in a positive way. And that's pretty interesting research, and it's very well done research where they control statistically for all the other things that predict heart attack. So there is research on it, but it's never been connected to generativity, so I can't answer the question you've got there. Yeah, Michael.
What's the distinction between generativity and successful? In terms of, for example, have you had any stories of folks that might be highly generative adults, but if you will, were failures? In terms of, you know, every they've tried five different business ventures and each one of them did not succeed.
Well, I don't think you will find highly generative adults who are failures across the board in everything. Okay, which is to say they feel that they've been a failure as a provider, failure as a parent, failure as a citizen. I mean, there's going to be some area where they feel that they've had a positive impact. Otherwise, they wouldn't score high on our generativity measures. But it doesn't have to be professional success. I mean, you know, some of our most generative adults are individuals in our research who really haven't distinguished themselves at all in terms of success, in, as we typically think of it, professionally or in terms of work. Maybe people who haven't even done paid work much, and, you know, it's sort of secondary to them. I think there are, you know, it's not necessary to have career success to be highly generative. And furthermore, I think there are, in fact, we've got them in our research, lots of individuals who've been very successful in terms of careers and who aren't especially generative, okay? But I think there's got to be some success in some area, okay? I mean, I think if you feel you've been a failure across the board, then that's not going to go with generativity, probably.
I was just trying to think of an example where generativity could maybe have negative effects.
Okay.
So you could be a very committed Christian with very, very high moral values, and you also believe that Jesus is coming very, very soon.
Yeah, sure.
Hence, we don't have to worry about the environment. So you have to somehow, somewhere along there, you have to kind of look at facts and think.
You do. You do. There are highly generative adults who are convinced that Jesus is going to come next week. And
yeah.
There are a lot of highly generative adults who think that those people are crazy. you're definitely right. I mean, like, where do you invest your resources? Well, I grew up in the Baptist Church, and we learned that Jesus could come any moment. So you better go home tonight and convert your parents, which I try to do a few times, maybe anywhere with them. But that sense of urgency, I'm not in that tradition anymore, so I kind of look back at it. Like it, but at the same time, there's something really impressive about that urgency. That we were committed, darn it. And I think there is something about thinking, like the end is soon. Generativity really is kind of about that. I mean, like you're only going to be here for a while, so you want to leave some positive legacy. So, if the end is imminent in some sense, you want to do as much as you can to promote before it's imminent. It can be a problem. It can be a problem. It depends on your perspective. I mean, if we're sitting here talking to a group who are like-minded evangelicals who believe that, then they're saying right on. Basically, there's nothing wrong there. But I'm with you. I find it problematic when there are so many problems in the world to worry about. Limited resources being one, world hunger, war. It's one thing about growing up in the fundamentalist church that I grew up in at the time, and one of the reasons I think I left it was it was very intense, but it was so focused and on, what's going on in your life and the people immediately around you, and you got to save them. But like, what about the world? There's so much going on in the world and the environment and so on, right? Yeah. So generativity can go in lots of different directions, and I actually believe that, the culture wars we have now between left and right in our society, I mean, it's highly generative adults who are leading the charge on each side. It's not the ones in the middle who think, whatever. They're low generative. They don't care that much. What else you got? We're kind of segueing into some of the negatives. Yes, sir?
I think you partially answered the question for me, but in the context of religious beliefs,
yes.
Is there anything in your research that indicates what precipitates or generates the generativity mindset?
Yeah, how do you get there, right? Well, this is a question, a very good question. It's a question I get from my colleagues, developmental psychologists. Great, Dan, but how do people get to be generative? Can we make people generative and so forth? And,
exactly.
And they'll say, you can look at your interviews and that might tell you something. And I say, no, I don't think so, because my interviews are really about a reconstruction of the past. You'd have to really do research where you follow people up from childhood, a longitudinal kind of research, and see what are the factors that predict this stuff. There is data, there are some data on that, and to the extent we know anything, and we don't know much, the one factor that does show up in a couple of nationwide studies done by a consortium headed by Alice Rossi, who's an eminent sociologist, the one factor that does seem to show up is early involvement in a religious tradition, predicting generativity down the road. But beyond that, the research is too new. We've only been doing the research on generativity for like 10, 15 years, and the studies that are set up longitudinally, they've been going for a long time, they're not set up well for us to figure out the answers to your questions. There could be a zillion different. So this story, the redemptive self, okay, we were edging a little bit towards a critique of it, with some of the issues that have come up here. Let's go with that a little bit more.
I've argued that this is a, in many ways, a story that provides psychological sustenance for generativity. It's a story that empowers the self to feel that she or he can make a difference in the world in a positive way. It helps to believe that you're special, that you're chosen, that something good happened early on in your life to give you the advantage that others didn't have. And in gratitude now you can give back. And if you've got pretty firm moral views here, and if you see your life as built on a pretty solid foundation that was laid down in your adolescence regarding values and so forth, well, then that, you know, that, if you, to use the metaphor I started with here, you know, the house that's built on that can withstand a lot of turmoil, and hurricanes can come through, and tornadoes, and bad weather, all kinds of adversity, but, you know, it's going to stand. It's going to stand. You're going to be able to persevere through it. And it's such an optimistic story, indeed. And the highly generative adults see the future in positive terms. And not like, you know, Pollyannish, oh, it's all going to be wonderful in the long run. But they do see themselves as making a positive difference in their corner of the world, be it through their community, their family, their church, and so forth. So what's not to like about a story this good?
Your view is that your suffering did not have anything good come out of it, and you're sitting with a generative person who's trying to get you to find meaning in your suffering so that you can feel better about yourself. Like, I think.
You want to hit him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, that gets at a key and it's implicit in what you said before, too. And it's not so much maybe a problem of generativity, but a problem of the rejective self. And that is the assumption. Maybe that just about anything can be redeemed. Okay? You know, there's suffering, bad things happen, but usually good things follow. And, well, maybe not, right? The first day here, and I apologize to you who were here because this is a bit of a replay, but I read this short passage from an article that appeared in The Atlantic about a year after September 11, 2001, written by William Langerweis, a journalist who had spent 9 or so months with firefighters and others who were working at the World Trade Center site after the bombing, or after the plane destruction, to find survivors and clear away the rubble. And what he noticed so much, and what becomes the main theme of the article for Langerweis as an observer, is what he called the kind of exuberant, characteristically American response to this, that, well, you know, we're gonna find survivors. Yeah, they're in there. Of course, they didn't. They didn't find too many, did they? And we're going to clear it away. And we're going to rebuild. And this city is going to be better than it ever was before. And, you know, we're just going to get in there, and we're going to make a difference. And, like, there's just no doubt that this is going to work out. In other words, there's going to be redemption down the road. The terrible tragedy that we all witnessed, and some people witnessed much more closely than others, family members of those who died and so forth, to say nothing of those who died themselves, all of that, you know, will in some way or another lead to a positive meaning. And, well, is that the way to think about it? Okay? Is that the way to think about the death of a child? Okay? You used a great example before. Somebody is in grief about the loss of a loved one, and I think of the death of a child because for me as a parent of, you know, teenage kids, I can't think of anything. My life right now, if that would happen. And I know people who've been through this. And you know, I don't know what the right response is, but I kind of think that the wrong response is exactly as you suggested, that, hey, God had a plan. Okay? I always actually thought that was the idea that, you know, bad things happen to you because of God's plan. Even as a Baptist kid, I remember that I thought that was a weird thing. Back in fourth grade, Paul Simons, sitting next to me in class, he broke his arm. And he had like his finger in this little contraption. He had to keep exercising it or else it wouldn't roll back right. And I remember his telling me, like, you know, 3 weeks into this, he said, I think God did this to me for a purpose. I don't know, Paul. I think you just fell. I didn't say that. But, you know, maybe You know, maybe Paul's right. I mean, it could be part of a larger plan. So you know, can everything be redeemed? But is it maybe good nonetheless to think of things? I mean, I don't know what people want to say about that.
What do you want to say? The thing that you just mentioned about the heart incidents would tend, at least there, seem to indicate that if you can have a positive frame of mind, you've created, you've maybe at least tipped the scales better, whether it's mind over matter or...
Power positive thinking, right?
Yeah.
So Norman Vincent Peale wrote about power positive thinking, and then Shelley Taylor, who's a social psychologist, wrote a book about 20 years ago called Positive Illusions, and she basically makes the argument, I think, that you're sort of onto there, and that is, well, it's probably not right that good things will always follow bad things, or it's probably not right that, you know, it's obviously not right that everybody's above average, right, as in the Garrison Keillor talk with Lake Wobegon, all the children are above average, all the men are good looking, all the women strong, all the children are above average, or something like that. Well, everybody can't be above average, right? And how do you know good things always follow? But I guess if you believe it, if you labor under those kinds of illusions, it can have benefit. And Taylor reviews tons of research in social psychology to say, yeah, it does. Okay? It's the people who have this clear-eyed, brutally honest assessment of things who don't flourish after illness and so forth. It's the ones who are sort of thinking, yeah, right, I mean, it's bad, but it could be worse. And I think I'm going to get better. And so there's some real power in positive thinking like that, some of which has a redemptive feel, and not all of it. But, yeah.
I think Jung said mankind can only take so much.
Yeah, Jung. Well, Jung, my reading of Jung is that he didn't take too much reality himself. That he was like completely in his own world, but totally. I mean, you need to kind of step back from the brutal.
On the other hand, then it will leave you mired in illusions. Sometimes you got to take a little
bit of damage. 25%. Other thoughts on the redemptive self? Good things, negative things, problems with this story? Ways in which,
for me, one of the problems with it is that, you know, you're always expecting and looking towards the future on something that's going to be better than right now.
Yeah, progress, man, progress.
And so you're not considering the here and now. That it's not really, you're always chasing after something instead of, you know, living with the blessings of your life or the status of your life at the time.
I think there is something to that in this story. Now, I mean, to be fair to the highly generative adults, the way the interview is set up, I sort of kind of privilege narratives of change and movement and how you look to the future. But you're definitely on to something. When people talk about, you know, well, I think, you know, you need to live in the moment and so forth, and sort of, those usually aren't my highly generative adults who talk that way, okay? They're often the less generative. Now, these are midlife adults, too. I mean, I don't know, younger people. I kind of think this story isn't really a good one for younger adults or teenagers and so forth. And maybe it's not a good story for people in their later years. But I definitely think you're onto something, this notion that there is this forward thrust. I mean, there's this look to the future, and there's also this, you know, upward and onward progress narrative, very American kind. You know, it's like you look at the charts every quarter to see if you're continuing to make profits. You're going up, you're going up. Right? It's a good business report. Yes.
You talked a little bit about Gandhi, about how he excelled in one area of his life, and yet he was not so good in other areas. How often do you see that in generative adults?
Well, we had thought originally that we would be able to develop measures of generativity that could tease out different dimensions of it. We weren't able, our measures are not as sensitive. However, there are other researchers, Shelley McDermott in particular, Purdue University, does some very good research here, where she basically talks about domain-specific generativity. So, okay, you got generativity in this domain, bam. And then you got generativity in this domain, civic stuff. And then she's got like five of these domains. And she loves to show how, you know, people who are good in one might not be too good in another and so forth. In general, you do see that. You do see some of that. But actually,
you also see a fair amount of correlation among inmates as well. In her research, I have not seen her kind of, what would be really interesting would be to document the lives of people who really excel like Gandhi in one area, but are like disasters in another. And that would be really cool research to do, just to see like what those lives are about, what those stories are about. I haven't seen it.
I'm thinking of the people, some of the people that we would call famous redemptive self people, like Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Jesus, would not be the people who would have said when they confronted difficult times, oh, whatever, you know, I think better days are coming. I mean, isn't part of the lesson, that part of their lesson, that you do need to walk through the fire and be in it and suffer to be transformed, instead of saying, oh gee, I think there's some good in this, la-di-da. I mean, their story seems to be a different lesson.
So are you suggesting that their stories are...
defy the research.
Defy the research in the sense that there's no expectation that they will get through something.
I don't know about that, but that you need to really feel the suffering.
Because highly generative adults would not disagree with that in their life story. They really feel the suffering of the child.
But
they come out of it. It's an interesting point. I've actually got a postdoc who works with me who's sort of addressing the question that you're raising, I think. And she talks about, well, you know, a lot of times there's cheap redemption. People go through something, wasn't that bad, come on, they got through it really quick. And then there's other people who like really go to the battle to the pit. And they just it becomes an all-consuming negative thing, and they work it through and they come out of it. And isn't that really a more meaningful kind of life transformation than form? She actually has some research to show that people who report events like that, where they really went down far, and they really processed it. There's a lot of processing to come out of it. Not necessarily happier. They're not happier, but they show higher levels of maturity in other psychological domains. So I don't know how Jesus would have done it.
C.S. Lewis, I was thinking of him and his agreement, observed, you know, his processing the death of his wife, and really working in it and being in it and coming through it. Some of that just seems more honest.
Yeah.
Whether
that's what she says on post time. That's interesting. Yes.
I think that when people have suffered and have come through this suffering, and they are much better equipped to work with other people who are suffering to help them.
I think that, you know, I mean, going back to the example of being bereaved parents, for example, who lost a child, and you know, support groups of other people who've gone through this kind of thing. And I think in those cases, I mean, they're not likely to get somebody to say something like, yeah, don't worry about it, it's part of God's plan. They're going to be able to empathize more. And that's where you see some wonderful examples of people helping each other. The shared suffering, and the empathy that comes from that, you just can't manufacture that. You know, if you haven't been through it, you can try to imagine it and so forth, but it's just really tough. And so it raises a good point. Yeah. And a lot of redemption happens in communities, right? Like-minded sufferers, Alcoholics Anonymous, other support groups, right? What do we have in common? Well, if it's an AA group, what we all have in common is that we're drunks. We're addicted to alcohol. That's the first thing we admit, right? Like, we're powerless. On our own, we can't beat this thing. And it's always going to be with us. But together, as we tell our stories and share, you know, redemption can occur, at least recovery. We continue to recover. I mean, one of the things that I'm really interested about 12-step programs like AA is that it's an unfinished, always developing kind of quality of redemption. You're never there. You're never in the promised land. Always recovering, you're always, you know, but at any point you could fall back. And you know, I think there's something kind of like very compelling to be honest about that, about life, okay? You know, you shouldn't stop and say, okay, now I lived it, I'm through that. For me, it seems more honest to see it as a process.
Yeah,
got a couple more minutes for other questions regarding any of this material. Yes.
So one of the things that, you know, as I was thinking about, is, as you were saying earlier about really being able to feel that pain and get into that suffering and, you know, really experience it, rather than just kind of gloss it over and, oh, it's going to be okay, that it's, you know, I guess before, earlier in the week, I had kind of gotten the impression that it was those individuals that were just, had something negative, but thought, oh, it's going to be okay, rather than those that really suffered through it, felt the pain, felt the anguish. And I just look at my own life and the individuals in my own life, that those that will really sit in the pain and really feel it and get all they can from it, learn all they can, and go through the process and really come out maybe a year later, maybe 5 years later, but with some meaning, with some clarity, and those that just kind of brush through it and say, oh yeah, it's always going to be okay, and that kind of superficial, almost annoying quality of, oh, yeah. Are you not real? Do you not feel, and you know?
Well, you know, I totally relate to what you're talking about. I don't think our research is able to distinguish clearly between those two. I think you have highly generative adults at both times, to tell you the truth, in our work. But you're definitely on to something very, very important. There's also a kind of related phenomenon in the literature that I read that I find very interesting too. This is the concept of resilience. It's the word that's used in everyday talk. And there are a couple of researchers who've looked at this in a very interesting context. These are people who go through really bad stuff and don't seem to feel the pain. Okay? And like my impression would be, well, yeah, they're in denial, right? Or they're going to feel it later, or they're not fully functioning. Actually, I still believe that. But the research done by this guy, George Bonanno, out of Columbia, it's one people, the research shows that I'm wrong. Now, it's just a few studies, and I still think I'm not wrong, but the research suggests that, you know, these folks are fine down the road. Okay, I've seen what you're doing, your wife passed away. Yeah, well, I felt some pain, but, you know, like, they don't show the sleeplessness, they don't report, well, I mean, they report some sadness, don't get me wrong, it's not like the next day they're out, you know, celebrating, but they don't go to the, they don't even have, they dip a little, okay, but not really way down, so they don't tell redemptive sequences in their lives, because they don't really go through really bad stuff. They seem almost impervious to really bad stuff. So what's that about? Now, I haven't done research on that kind of thing. It'd be interesting to sort of like get the life stories of those kinds of folks and see what's going on there. If I were to critique the work, I think probably what Bonanno's outcome measures are mainly things like happiness and life satisfaction. But if you were looking at some sort of deeper issues having to do with self-insight and maybe like contributions to others, he might see that resilience wouldn't predict that. But I don't know.
You have to look at their personality profile.
Well, yeah,
I do. What kind of person they are.
What kind of person they are in great detail. And the studies I'm thinking of have to go on to detail. Got time for one more? Yes?
Well, my thought on that was just that sometimes that is a survival method, too. By surviving, you either those that, you know, say in prison camps and so forth. That's how they survive. I just finished this book talking about she had to help throw the dead bodies into the fire. And
in
Auschwitz, yeah. And she said, all she could do was think of they were in a better situation, but to personally feel of what she was being asked to do, it just kind of ran this pattern that by this ability, like someone asked her to eat rotten cabbage, and she did it. She said, I felt like throwing up for hours afterwards, but there was that something in that person. She's alive today. And she recognizes too that a lot of love, too. But that was how she survived, was
Rollo May's book, Man's Search for Meaning. I don't know if many people have read it, but it's a really powerful account. I was reminded of it as you're talking. He's a survived concentration camp, went on to be a fairly renowned psychoanalytic theorist. And in this book, he talks about how, you know, you become sort of machine-like in these situations. And as a way of getting through it, you know, you just can't process it. You just have to kind of get through it. And he also underscores luck, a lot of that. And in fact, there's this really powerful phrase there where he says, the best of us were left behind. And he's almost sort of suggesting that, you know, if you're in those situations, if you think too much about the good and the moral, it could work against you. And I actually think it's ironic because I think he was one of the best, and he did survive, and it's one of my great heroes. But it's really very, very much like you're talking about. And actually, those accounts go against the redemptive self in some fundamental way. They do suggest that the world is rather more random and tragedy is more the norm than redemption. I think the story of Job, to a certain extent, sort of defies this kind of story. And also why I love the redemptive self. I think it's a very powerful narrative. There are many other ways to narrate life, and sometimes situations require that we narrate them in ways that that fit the circumstances and that promote our own efforts to have some positive effect on the world around us. We are out of time. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy your time here.
Thank you.